This is Functional Medicine Update for May 2002, Volume 22, Number 5. Our theme this month is the nutritional relationship to health and disease. Our interview is with Dr. Walter Willett, chairman of the Harvard School of Public Health and author of Eat, Drink, and Be Healthy. Here is Dr. Jeffrey Bland.
Well, this is the month I've been looking forward to with great anticipation, our 9th International Symposium on Functional Medicine to be held at the Fort Lauderdale Diplomat Hotel. I hope you're signed up and going to join us for this extraordinary meeting on brain biochemistry, neuropsychiatric, and neurophysiological function. And I think we're going to have a great time over Memorial Day weekend, the 25th through the 28th of May. So look forward to seeing you there. This month, we're going to be focusing principally on where nutritional decisions are made and how they're made and how they influence functional health over the course of aging. And let me, if I can, however, start off by talking about the whole way that we have approached the food health story, looking at associations, epidemiology, looking at historical information from anthropology, looking at animal data, looking at cell culture work, taking information from wherever we can across wide ranges of disciplines to try to put together first a hypothesis and later hopefully a testable methodology to evaluate nutritional relationships to health and disease. Well, when we start seeing very interesting intervention papers like the one that just appeared in the New England Journal of Medicine, volume 345, page 1583, entitled Simvastatin and Niacin, Antioxidant Vitamins or the Combination for the Prevention of Coronary Disease, it leads us into a very interesting dialectic. Are drugs or food better? And as you know, on the basis of epidemiological data, it's been predicted that each 1% reduction of the level of low-density lipoprotein cholesterol results in a reduction of 1 to 1.5% in the risk of major cardiovascular events. This is further amplified with the HDL association that says that for every 1 milligram per deciliter increase of HDL, there's a 2 to 3% reduction in the risk of cardiac events, and this seems to be independent of LDL levels. So this LDL-HDL ratio becomes very important, and strategies that are designed to try to improve that ratio, lowering LDL and increasing HDL, have been suggested to have very important effects upon reducing the risk of cardiovascular disease. In this particular paper, to evaluate different methodologies for reducing cardiovascular disease incidence and progression of atherosclerosis, they use simvastatin along with niacin. It's a slow-release niacin given either at doses of 250 milligrams twice daily up to as high as 1,000 milligrams twice daily for 4 weeks. And they contrasted that then with individuals who also got antioxidant vitamins or antioxidants plus niacin and simvastatin versus a placebo. The antioxidant vitamins that were administered were 800 IUs per day of D-alpha tocopherol, vitamin E, 1,000 milligrams of ascorbic acid, vitamin C, 25 milligrams of natural beta-carotene and 100 micrograms of selenium were the formulations that were given against a placebo capsule on a daily basis. These are in patients that have varying degrees of atherosclerosis. Their cholesterol levels were evaluated. Their plaque formation was evaluated by angiography. It was a very detailed study looking at lipoprotein fractionation and the degree of stenosis. It was quite fascinating when you examine the table 3, which was the data table, because the first thing you see is that the simvastatin plus niacin had a very synergistic effect, improving many of the functional parameters related to cardiovascular function, lowered number of proximal lesions, reduced amount of stenosis, mean change in minimal luminal diameter was improved with the simvastatin and niacin therapy, much more than simvastatin given alone. Antioxidant vitamins, however, which had a positive impact over that of placebo, was not statistically significant. However, there was a very wide range of variability, suggesting inter-individual changes, and this is a theme that will emerge from this month's FMU, as it has in the previous FMUs, and that is, what is the right nutrition for the individual? Personalized nutrition. We're not all one-size-fits-all, and our generalized concepts that antioxidants are good for everybody may not be true as it relates to what it is that we're talking about. So there's a wide range of variability from person to person. The statistical significance of antioxidants was not at the level of significance as compared to the very significant improvement with simvastatin-niacin combination. Then when antioxidants were added to the simvastatin-niacin in another arm of the trial, one sees some parameters improving, others not improving. However, it certainly does not improve over that of simvastatin-niacin. In fact, the effects are less evident than simvastatin niacin. So simvastatin niacin is the best. Simvastatin niacin plus antioxidants is not as good. You don't get positive synergy, you get negative synergy. Antioxidant vitamins by themselves do not reach the level of statistical significance. There's a drift towards improvement, but a high inter-individual variability, certainly not as good as either of the other two arms of the trial, but better than placebo. So they conclude that contrary to the hypothesis that antioxidants might provide the greatest benefit in early lesions, in this study they had no effect on stenosis in the 0 to 29% of the luminal diameter group. The clinical and angiographically measurable benefit of simvastatin plus niacin were greater than those that would be expected from statins alone, suggesting that niacin lends another positive benefit beyond that of the HMG-CoA reductase inhibition of statins. When antioxidants were combined with simvastatin and niacin, this was a very big surprise. Arterial and clinical benefits tended to diminish as compared with those achieved with simvastatin and niacin alone, and the adverse interaction between these two therapeutic strategies seemed to be quite significant at the PO2 level of statistical significance. This interaction appears to result from substantial and specific blending of the role that the antioxidant vitamins in this regime had on the expected increase in the level of protective HDL2 subfraction, and applied to roughly 40% of patients with coronary disease who have low HDL cholesterol levels, but who rarely use combination therapy targeted at both LDL and HDL. We know that thyroid hormone T3 will raise HDL. We know that exercise will raise HDL. We know that alcohol in modest amounts will raise HDL. We know that niacin will raise HDL. We know that chromium will often raise HDL, but it does not appear as if antioxidant vitamins have a favorable effect in this regard and actually may lower HDL. And therefore, the conclusion is antioxidants in and of themselves do not provide demonstrable statistically significant benefit over simvastatin and niacin therapy. And there may be some individuals, and we call them subgroups or cohorts, for whom antioxidants are very important, at least the vitamin E, carotene, vitamin C, selenium amounts that were used in this study, and others who may actually get adverse influence from this. Again, one size does not fit all. Vitamin E is more than just an antioxidant. It has a very important intracellular communication role. This was discussed recently in Nutrition Reviews, Volume 60, page 8. In which the discussion was around how it relates to cell signaling that may have influences on atherogenesis. It inhibits platelet aggregation and pro-inflammatory activity of monocytes, and therefore it may then lower the risk to smooth muscle proliferation and endothelial function. It may actually change the kind of plaque that is formed, making it more plastic or more fluid type of plaque, and a plaque that's less likely to dislodge, to break off, and to stimulate platelet adherence and a thrombus formation. So it may be the composition of plaque that's changed as a consequence of vitamin E, as well as the dynamics at the arterial wall, the stickiness of white blood cells that undergo transmigration to become foam cells. So we can't necessarily rush to the conclusion that just because there are lower small atherosclerotic lesions that are present within the arterial wall, that these will necessarily have the same degrees of pathogenicity. Different types of lesions may have different pathogenicity, and vitamin E may play a role in the reduction of pathogenicity as a consequence of its effect on monocyte, macrophage function, arterial wall adhesion, rolling and migration, and ultimately then the production of oxidized LDL. Vitamin C is much more than just an antioxidant, just as vitamin E is a modulator of intercellular communication. In a recent paper in The Lancet, which I found fascinating, they talked about the preventive effects of vitamin C on carcinogenesis, and they point out that many dietary phenolic substances have stronger antioxidant effects than do vitamin C when tested in vitro. However, the mechanism for the inhibitory actions of vitamin C on carcinogenesis may go beyond its antioxidant effects. These investigators noted that vitamin C has a preventive effect on inhibition of hydrogen peroxide-induced gap junction intracellular communication. In other words, like vitamin E, vitamin C plays a role in modulating certain types of intercellular communication. Gap junction intercellular communication is essential for maintaining the homeostatic balance through modulation of cell proliferation and differentiation in the multicellular organism. Inhibition of gap junction intercellular communication is strongly related to the carcinogenic process, especially to tumor promotion. Hydrogen peroxide, which we know to be a tumor promoter, induces inhibition of gap junction intracellular communication and hyperphosphorylation of connexin 43 protein, a gene response element. In investigating the effects of vitamin C on gap junction intracellular communication and phosphorylation patterns within the connexin 43 gene, It was found that vitamin C played a very important role in kind of buttressing against hydrogen peroxide and its effect on gap junction intercellular communication, much more so than other free radical scavengers such as propylgalate or trolox, which are good antioxidants, in fact far better than vitamin C, but not nearly as effective as gap junction intercellular communication modulators. The investigators go on to say then that vitamin C might therefore have an anti-tumor promoting effect through a different mechanism than just its straight antioxidant mechanism, suggesting that the mechanistic basis might be through its modification or inhibition of gap junction intercellular communication initiated by free radicals such as hydrogen peroxide. The bioflavonoid quercetin also has a very powerful role, in fact even more so on a mole basis, in modulating gap junction intracellular communication than vitamin C. So a combination of vitamin C and quercetin may have very favorable effects working together. Let's move beyond just that of the vitamin E, vitamin C, selenium carotenoid story and also look at other natural products which modulate cholesterol dynamics, and one that has come to light recently that's very exciting because it does not only lower LDL, but it elevates HDL, is polycosanol. A recent paper in the American Heart Journal, volume 143, page 356 in 2002, reviews a series of studies, in fact, in excess of 30 different studies in humans that have evaluated this either sugarcane wax, beeswax, derived mixture of long-chain waxy alcohols that are called polycosanols, P-O-L-I-C-O-S-A-N-O-L-S. These particular materials appear to have a very powerful lipid-lowering effect, particularly in humans with modestly elevated LDL cholesterols and suppressed HDLs. At the levels of 10 milligrams per day, the most common study dose, in a bioavailable form, it was capable of lowering LDL cholesterol by 25% while increasing HDL cholesterol on average by 29%. So it has a very favorable influence on the ratio of LDL to HDL cholesterol. The article goes on to say that studies suggest that LDL catabolism with polycosanols may be enhanced, possibly through receptor-mediated mechanisms, meaning it's more than just an HMG-CoA reductase inhibitor. In fact, it probably doesn't work through that mechanism, which may be why it has a different effect on coenzyme Q10 biosynthesis than do the statins, because it's working through a different mechanism. It has additional beneficial properties by lowering smooth muscle cell proliferation, platelet aggregation, and the peroxidizability of LDLs, one of the mechanisms by which atherogenesis can be initiated. So now it seems like there's a new natural product which is available that may have favorable effects on normalizing cholesterol dynamics that doesn't require statins. One might consider using this along with slow-release niacin, for instance, and looking its effect on blood lipids and ratio of lipoproteins, such as LDL to HDL, and connecting that together then with individuals who may have specific types of immunological reactions that are associated with atherogenesis. These may be the pro-inflammatory people with upregulation of the high-sensitivity CRP, the people whose atherosclerosis is initiated through an inflammatory cascade. For these individuals, maybe the antioxidant therapy would be considered much more desirable than the average individual for whom atherosclerosis is initiated by other mechanisms. I think what we're starting to recognize is that atherosclerosis may be initiated by a variety of different mechanisms that all work together to create the same pathophysiology, some of which may respond to different therapies, including antioxidants themselves, which I find to be a very fascinating part of the story. So a person with a suppressed HDL, elevated LDL, may be more likely a responder to things like polycosanols and niacin than the antioxidant therapies. We also know that soy protein and soy isoflavones have favorable effects on serum lipids. In postmenopausal women, it's been shown that proper normal intake, 56 to 90 milligrams of isoflavones a day in soy protein, can help to normalize cholesterol and reduce the statistical risk to heart disease. One has said, but isn't at that level there going to be an adverse effect on thyroid function or on estrogen receptor binding sites or some other deleterious endocrine effect from taking soy at that level? A recent paper in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, volume 75, page 145 in 2002, looked at the effect of soy protein at the two levels I described, 56 milligrams of isoflavones a day at 90 milligrams of isoflavones, and lo and behold, they found that in postmenopausal women there was no adverse effect on any of the endocrine parameters that were measured, including FSH, LH, testosterone, estrogen, progesterone, estrogen metabolites, including the 2 and 16 hydroxylated estrogens, thyroid, thyroid-stimulating hormone, DHEA. All of these particular hormones were not adversely influenced by regular intake of soy at the doses that I just described, which would be considered normal dietary intake, 2 to 3 portion sizes of soy products per day. This comes from a very stellar group of collaborators from multiple centers that have, I think, finally helped us to recognize that soy is not the risk that some people are making it out to be in terms of endocrine dysfunction, including thyroid dysfunction. We also recognize that soy isoflavones reduce oxidative stress in men and women and alter then the oxidizability of serum lipids, LDL, and therefore may have another beneficial effect on dynamics other than just cholesterol modulating effects. They may also influence then, again, the immunological parameters related to inflammation and atherosclerosis. This comes from a recent paper in Cancer Letters, Volume 172, page 1 through 6 in 2001, talking about the effect of soy isoflavone supplementation on these markers of oxidative stress. We also know that beyond soy and beyond the polycosanols also exists another interesting risk to coronary atherosclerosis. It's dietarily modifiable, and that's the folic acid B12 homocysteemic condition that Dr. Kilmer McCulley has brought to our attention. Recently, it's been found that there is about 30% plus of the population that carries a unique genetic susceptibility called the methylene tetrahydrofolate reductase polymorphism, or MTHFR, as it's abbreviated. And these individuals, depending on whether they're homozygous or recessive, or heterozygous, the homozygous represent probably about 10 to 12% of the population. So 1 out of 10, 1 out of 8 individuals may carry this homozygous recessive characteristic. And these are individuals who cannot process dietary folate as effectively into the active methylating form of folate, which is called 5-methyl tetrahydrofolate. A recent paper in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, volume 75, page 275, talks about individuals with the MTHFR, what's called C677T polymorphism, or SNP, single nucleotide polymorphism, and how they respond to either folic acid or 5-methyl tetrahydrofolic acid supplementation. And it's been shown that individuals with the homozygous recessive form respond favorably to 5-methyl tetrahydrofolate, meaning they can lower their homocysteines and have proper production of the methylating agent called SAM, S-adenosylmethionine. That's the active methylating agent that the enzyme catechol-O-methyltransferase uses to transfer methyl groups to neurotransmitters and bioamines and to phospholipids, even to detoxify hormones to create proper function. So individuals who carry MTHFR polymorphism, for them, proper nutrition might be either increased levels of folic acid, preferentially by supplementation because it's more absorbable than it is from food folates, which are polyglutamyl folates, and or the use of 5-methyl tetrahydrofolate as a specific supplement to bypass that metabolic susceptibility that's found in their genotype, what might call the small wire, which is the MTHFR polymorphism. Now, what about individuals who have increased serum lipids, particularly triglycerides and LDLs, the dense LDL particles, and may be what we call individuals who are exhibiting metabolic syndrome, or syndrome X, that Dr. Gerald Reaven, one of our past FMU clinicians, described to us. A recent paper in the Journal of the American Medical Association talked about the effects of diet, simvastatin on serum lipids, insulin, and antioxidant levels in these hypercholesterolemic men. This was a randomized controlled trial, and I found this very interesting because they used a modified Mediterranean-type diet, which was rich in omega-3 fatty acids, and it was found to potentiate the cholesterol-lowering effects of simvastatin, and it counteracted the fasting insulin-elevating effects of the statin drug, which is known to be one of the adverse side effects, is it increases insulin resistance and increases fasting insulin levels. And unlike simvastatin, it also did not result in the decrease in levels of either beta-carotene or ubiquinol 10 or coenzyme Q10. So by using a dietary intervention program along with a statin drug, one got apparently improved physiological endpoints and reduced risk. It was a synergistic effect. So when we talk about diet or drugs, there's a place where they can be used in combination and compatibility to get synergistic improvement. And this is very beautifully described in this paper, volume 287, page 598 in the year 2002 in the Journal of American Medical Association. By the way, as you probably know, this metabolic syndrome is not uncommon in our society. Depending upon the degree of severity it can be seen as frequently as 20% of the population. These are people potentially on their way to either type 2 diabetes or the cardiovascular disorders that may occur even before they get the diagnosis of type 2 diabetes. In a recent paper in the Journal American Medical Association, volume 287, page 356 in 2002, it was suggested that the age-adjusted prevalence of metabolic syndrome were 21.8% and 23.7% respectively in the United States, with certain ethnicities having even a higher prevalence than that, up to as high as 42% found in, for instance, Native American Pima Indians, where you have a very significant increased metabolic risk based upon various susceptibility factors in diet and lifestyle. So I think this is a very remarkable example, suggesting, according to 2000 census data, that about 47 million Americans have the metabolic syndrome. It may be one of the most important precursors to later stage disorders, including type 2 diabetes. Then we couple that with the paper that appeared in the New England Journal of Medicine, which is entitled Reduction in the Incidence of Type 2 Diabetes with Lifestyle Intervention or Metformin. This is the most common drug that's often used to manage type 2 diabetes, or lifestyle intervention with diet and exercise. What were the results of this head-on-head trial? One trying to prevent with medication, the other trying to prevent with diet and lifestyle. Very powerful study, again, talking about the important role that nutrition will play in the future of medicine as we learn more about how to individualize and personalize and to improve compliance by giving better quality products and easier to apply programs. So what were the results of the study? It was found that lifestyle changes and treatment with metformin both were found to reduce the incidence of diabetes in people at high risk. However, the lifestyle intervention, diet and exercise, was more effective than that of metformin. This is a New England Journal of Medicine, volume 346, page 393 in the year 2002. And this interrelates this whole metabolic syndrome with other endocrinological abnormalities, not just the relative risk to heart disease, but also to things like menstrual irregularities in menstruating women as a consequence of insulin's interaction with 1720 lyase in the ovaries, an enzyme that's responsible for production of androgens. And as you know, very high insulin, hyperinsulinemia, and insulin resistance is associated with PCOS, polycystic ovary syndrome, and hyperandrogenicity. In fact, hyperandrogenicity in menstruating women is the most common endocrinological dysfunction found in those women. Much more common than hypoestrogenism is hyperandrogenism in the women. Facial hair, acne, changes in body composition, increasing visceral adipose tissue deposition, menstrual irregularities, and eventually ovarian cysts. So when we talk about PCOS, that's the late-stage diagnosis from an early-stage increasing severity of insulin resistance and how that interferes then with menstrual cycling and ovulation. And that's what was really determined in this particular paper in the Journal of the American Medical Association, volume 286, page 2421 in the year 2001, in which it was found that long or highly irregular menstrual cycles were a marker for the risk of type 2 diabetes as a consequence of increasing severity of insulin resistance, hyperandrogenicity, altered hormonal balance between estrogen and androgens, and therefore reproductive and menstrual irregularities in these young women. And later, then that would, if unrecognized, become a diabetes as it became more severe. So we start putting these things together as a web of interacting variables. In fact, they go on to say that one-third or more of diabetes mellitus cases are undiagnosed in the general population, and while screening bias, i.e. greater sensitivity of screening for diabetes in women with irregular cycles might contribute to observed results, they consider this to be an unlikely explanation for the fact that women with the menstrual irregularities, altered cycles, and menorrhagia later then have a much higher prevalence of diabetes, and when you examine their insulin levels, often they're hyperinsulinemic and insulin resistant. So again, we start weaving things together from an endocrinological perspective, from a functional perspective, and to a diet and lifestyle perspective, seeing these as possibly primary therapies more important than early intervention with medications themselves. We know that there are insulin mimetics now that have been studied to actually improve insulin sensitivity and lower body weight, suggesting that body fat deposition may come as a consequence of a metabolic irregularity. It wasn't that fat caused diabetes. It was that a metabolic disturbance then led to the dysregulation of insulin, leptin, neuropeptide Y, melanocyte-stimulating hormone, and this whole array of neuroendocrine hormones that then leads to the repartitioning of calories into storage form, adipocyte accumulation of fat, versus use as mechanical energy or as cellular energy. This is discussed very nicely in a recent paper that appeared in Nature Medicine, Volume 8, page 179, year 2002, talking about insulin mimetics and how they can lead to weight loss without even putting an animal on a calorie restriction diet because of their influence on this cellular economy, this neuroendocrinology of weight control. We know that elevated triglycerides and reduced HDL levels in patients are associated with this metabolic syndrome and this insulin resistance, and that circulating triglycerides and free fatty acids are a common features of the diabetic dyslipidemia and are associated with this insulin resistance. I'm now quoting from a recent issue of Nature Medicine, and that this is also associated with the production off the genes of different elements like the protein resistant that leads ultimately to central obesity and later stage correlates with type 2 diabetes. And leptin replacement therapy has been found to be useful for lipodystrophies, the increasing lipid deposition in central adipose tissue, which is interrelated with insulin signaling and with the other hormones that are related to the HPA axis and the HPT axis, the hypothalamus, pituitary, adrenal, and thyroid axis. This is all interrelated with stress and diet and environment and exercise patterns. It signals to the glucose transporters how to transport glucose and to regulate cellular energy economy at the mitochondria. Cinnamon and other nutritional factors have been found to increase cell signaling in insulin. In fact, there's three papers on insulin receptor